The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition this week. In this week's show, we're going to talk a bit about nuances with beneficiaries of inherited IRAs. I know this is a topic we touch on periodically, kind of almost regularly, and that's because, believe it or not, something that seems so simple ends up being more complicated than you could ever imagine, depending on the circumstances. And we have another listener-prompted topic connected to beneficiaries of inherited IRAs. I'll get to that in a second. The good news is, and I'm spinning this positively, the good news is I get to eat a little crow from the last Q&A show. Those of you listening to the last Q&A show, we answered a question about TSPs, and then kind of as an extension on that answer, the answer to the actual question we nailed, I'm pretty sure, but I added some kind of warnings of the forced distributions to a non-spouse. If you inherit a TSP and you're not the spouse, the inability to roll that over to an inherited IRA. And those were the old rules. I mentioned too, I was hoping I was wrong. And in this case, I was wrong. The document I was referencing was not the up-to-date document on the TSP. The document I was referencing for this rule, where I claimed that I'd verified it, I verified it against an old document. So good news is you can, in fact, as a non-spouse beneficiary, and if you're the recipient, you're inheriting a TSP from someone else, you are able to roll that into an inherited IRA now. So ignore that warning from the last show. We have, those of you who have downloaded it have the wrong version for eternity, but if you re-download it, I have corrected it. I expunged the violating words from that podcast so nobody in the future will be misled. But sorry about that. Not perfect. Try our best to get things right. That one I messed up, though. So, well, we messed up because Jim participated in the conversation, didn't correct me, which he'll claim.
In defense of me.
He'll claim it was because he wasn't paying attention, but.
That was on the tape. For those who remember, Chris went off.
Hang on. Something has changed from when we talked before. You've gotten excited or something because you're overloading your microphone. So.
No, I moved the microphone. Hold on.
Yeah, hang on here. Before we go any further, we don't want to do that the whole show.
Is that better?
That is much better. Plus, wow, contain your excitement, too. That's also part of it.
That was only a foot difference.
I know. It's crazy. Sound.
Damn. All right. But I sound okay now?
Yes. We'll see when you get excited, though.
I'll try not to. Well, it's hard to get excited out here in northern Kentucky, southern Ohio, because the damn trees still haven't changed color yet. I got one photo today. I was walking around a cemetery, mm-hmm. and
there
called
was
Spring.
One leaf.
Spring growth? No, there's one tree. It was like God shined down on me, and we'll put it in the newsletter next month. So it was well worth an 18-hour, 1,250-mile drive to pose next to that tree. and I have my fall foliage photo. But yeah, the damn trees out here, they're not turning. And all the locals are saying the same thing. Well, they're usually beautiful this time of year. It's me and my gremlins. I know it.
Could be.
And y'all, you think I have you been convinced yet that I have gremlins? Are you still in denial?
Oh, no, it is. Yes. When you say the machine or something that's malfunctioning has the gremlins, I'm convinced it is you. So, yes, it is. There's a definite aura, some electrical or gravitational field around you that affects electronics, trees.
Everything. It's just my life. But they're not mean gremlins. They're not looking to kill me. Hell, they could have killed me 10 times over. Just the stroke alone last year could have done me in. They're not looking to kill me. They're just looking to mess with me.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another example. Jim drives all the way out to Northern Kentucky, Southern Ohio to see fall foliage. And again, see if he wants to move here when he retires. And the trees just refuse to turn. They're beautiful shades of green. And slowly they are starting to turn. Everybody on today's walk, I don't want to call it a hike because it was a walk through a very beautiful cemetery and arboreum. Gorgeous, gorgeous trees. I was so hoping the big 200-plus-year-old trees here would have been turning on this cemetery called Spring Grove. But everybody was saying they're usually so beautiful this time of year. They don't know what's going on. And I know what's going on. They're going to be gorgeous the minute I leave. Sunday when I leave, they'll be walking on Tuesday, and they already joked they're going to take photos and send them to me about how gorgeous the trees are because they should be turning by now. But anyways, folks, that's about all I want to do. But in defense of me, that's what I was trying to say. I do remember that day and you were going off on a tangent and I totally spaced you out. Wasn't paying attention at all. I was looking up other things. And I do remember at one point saying, Chris, I wasn't paying attention to a thing you were saying. You sure you're right? And you informed me that you were right. But then again, you did explain and I still didn't pick up on it. Because I had so many other things on my mind, but I will try to pay much more attention and you try to pay more attention because I'm wrong sometimes too. I mean, I mm-hmm. joke that people spell my name wrong. They spell it C-H-R-I-S when they're pointing out an error, but hey, I make mistakes too. We're only human, but I do think the...
Well, it's just a reason why people can never stop listening to the podcast because you never know when the next episode we're going to fix something. So there you go. Talk about
it's ongoing.
Yeah, it's a lifetime commitment to be attached to the Retirement and IRA show.
Well, I think we get most of it. But when you told me today that this is what you wanted to chat about, I was torn on what today's EDU topic would be. Mm-hmm. Because last week I did my Ed Slot training. Mm-hmm. And you know I like to do two things now after the Ed Slot training. I have no idea what that noise was. Could you hear it?
No.
Oh, I guess only I can hear it.
More gremlins.
My computer made a noise. I mean, a loud one. You didn't hear that at all?
No.
All right. Well,
are you about to run out of battery or something?
No. It just made that window sound, you know, that attention. Something's wrong with your computer sound. Had that.
Didn't come across over here. That's just good.
It's my gremlins.
Yep.
But anyways, when you told me, I was thinking, well, I'm going to deviate and not do today's show. What I wanted to do after Ed Slot, I always like to do the court cases and the PLRs, and there's some good ones this time to review. And I'm sure listeners, longtime listeners at least, who love to be do-it-yourselfers, like that as well because they can kind of guess how the courts or IRS ruled. We're going to skip that. And things that make you go, a new series that I want to do after my Ed Slot meetings. We'll hold off on both of those and instead jump into something that happened to me just before I left for Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. Just before I left for Cincinnati, I had been chatting to some prospective clients and they had a unique situation. And they were sharing with me that they had inherited two IRAs, actually two Roth IRAs, from the parents, I believe, of the wife, but I could be wrong. Maybe it was the husband, but I believe the wife. And the father passed. No, I think it was the mom passed first. And for the story, it doesn't matter if the mom or the father passed first. One of the parents passed first. And then a few months later, the second parent passed away. And they had named each other as beneficiaries of their IRAs, but no contingent beneficiaries. So when the second spouse died, there was no one named on the IRAs, either the deceased first spouse, which I believe was the mother, but I'm not sure, or the second spouse. So they were wondering what their options were, and the custodian had told them that they had to close the IRAs within 5 years because essentially there was no named beneficiary, which the custodian was correct. At that point, there were no remaining surviving beneficiaries named on either of the two IRAs.
And it happened so close together, they probably hadn't gone through the actions of moving the one to the other spouses, the surviving spouses. So they were still sitting there, right, kind of in that waiting period until you take action.
Correct. But at first I did say to them, I says, well, all's not lost yet. You may have some options. I said, the first thing we need to do is get a copy of the custodial agreement, because when there's no named beneficiary, the IRA will pass by the custodial agreement. And let me pause there, listeners. That applies to pretty much any type of retirement account that you have. A 401k, you would go to the plan document. The TSP, which Chris was just talking about, and in fact, the TSP's document has a lot of potential people a TSP could go to before the estate would get it if there was no named beneficiary. In IRA, you go to what is called the custodial agreement. All plans will have this governing document because, as we said many times, listeners, the government sets parameters or rules, if you will, but they give custodians a lot of leeway into what parameter they want to adopt and what parameter they don't want to adopt. For instance, a lot of our listeners should know the still working exception. If you are still working after the age of 72 now, used to be 70 and a half, now it's 72. If you are still working, Chris, after 72, and you don't own more than 5% of the company, not 5% exactly, more than, so you can own 5% or less, you can delay your required minimum distributions until you retire. Everybody knows that. But not every 401k needs to adopt that rule. The government sets what the rules are. The custodians can say if they're going to adopt that or not. So that sometimes causes a little bit of confusion. So some custodians, Chris, will write very specific language in their governing document, whether it's the summary description or a custodial agreement or whatever document you're pulling, depending on the plan you have. Some get very creative and write it all out that if there's no named beneficiary, it goes here, it goes there, it goes there, until it finally gets to the estate, if you can make it through all these other potential beneficiaries. So that's what I was hoping at first, Chris, would be the case. Then I thought the next option, depending on the age of the people who passed away, we may be able to leave the IRA open for their remaining life expectancy. That's another rule. But when I got the age of the people who died, their remaining life expectancy, Chris, was 5.9 years. Now, when you have an IRA or a 401k, listeners, or a TSP plan, and the custodial agreement and the documents, there's still no one left, and ultimately it's going to the estate. So in other words, there is no named beneficiary or no named human beneficiary. You can name a dog, a tree. We said this in the past. There's nothing against the law on that. It's just not a human. So if there is no human beneficiary and no escape route, Chris, in the custodial agreement, the rule will be 5 years. You got to close the IRA within 5 years, or the remaining life expectancy of the decedent if the decedent died after 72. Those are the rules. So I thought, ooh, I'm not going to have stellar good news for this couple, but they can keep it open 5.9, not 5. That's what I thought. That's what I was thinking until I attended the Ed Slott meeting, and Ed just happened to be reviewing this very topic on the show. And then he said something, Chris, that made me go, damn it, it's not going to work. And that's what I want to talk about. I started realizing I've been doing this 23 years and there's still things that I forget. And I totally forgot this last bit of crucial information that will mean this person will have to close the IRAs, the Roth IRA accounts, Chris, in 5 years, not 5.9. But again, there's not much difference between 5 and 5.9. However, if someone dies, Chris, right around age 72, 73, that's after their required beginning date, obviously, because the required beginning date is April 1st of the year following the year they turn 72. If you die after that date, when there's no named beneficiary, the IRA can be closed in the remaining life expectancy of the decedent. There's that little loophole, I guess you could call it. Except for one other loophole that quickly closed that loophole. And I know I'm being a little evasive because I'm going to see if Chris can guess what it was. I totally forgot when I was thinking about this. And then instantly, as soon as Ed started reviewing this, Chris, it's like a light bulb went off in my head. I was like, darn, I'm not going to be able to do it. I totally forgot that. So let's just set the stage a little of what I'm getting to. So under the Secure Act, as you know, Chris, there are now three categories of beneficiaries. There's the non-designated beneficiary. That's the one where there is no human beneficiary. Even if you name your estate, that doesn't count as a human beneficiary. Even if your estate planning attorney has promised you your estate documents and will pass all your assets to humans, you still don't name your estate as beneficiary of the IRA because the government is still going to say there's no human. You want it to go to a human, name the human on the beneficiary form of your retirement account. So that's the first category, Chris. Then there is the non-eligible designated beneficiaries. And folks, Chris and I did not come up with these names. This is Congress. It was their brilliant idea to make them all sound the same. Non-designated beneficiary, non-eligible designated beneficiary, and eligible designated beneficiary. They sound too much the same, Chris, don't they?
I think so. But
It's
kind of legalese almost. They mean specific things to the implementers of these rules and regulations, but to the lay person, I think they're a bit confusing.
So a non-eligible designated beneficiary, folks, they are people who are human. So that's why they're not non-designated beneficiaries. They're human. I wish they would have just used the verbiage human, Chris. Non-human beneficiaries, human beneficiaries, and human beneficiaries who can stretch. That's what they should call them, because that's what they mean in English. So a non-eligible designated beneficiary is a human beneficiary who cannot stretch. And then an eligible designated beneficiary, folks, is a human who can stretch. That's the three categories. So let's look at this, because the situation I described, Chris, falls into the first category, correct? A non-human beneficiary, because there was just no one named at all.
Correct. Okay. Well, in this particular case, I don't think you mentioned that the custodial agreement named the estate as the person, the beneficiary, if there isn't a named beneficiary.
So correct.
That's important for this story.
Right. The first thing we did in the office was exactly what you described. What did we do, Chris?
Ask for the custodial agreement, because they all are different in this regard.
Correct. So the person got the custodial agreement and sent it to us. And I remember when Jacob sent it to me, because it was a long agreement, he says, good luck finding what you need. I actually found it quite quickly, because it's usually at the beginning of all custodial agreements. Not right at the beginning, but very, very close to the start of the custodial agreements, where they clearly specify who will get it. And this custodian, I don't want to name them because they're not here to defend themselves, is a very good custodian, well-known name. We talk about them all the time on the podcast, and no Vanguardians, it's not Vanguard. So I'll at least calm y'all down on that. But we've mentioned this custodian's name in the past before. If I said it, everyone would recognize it. Anyways, it simply said no named beneficiary. It goes to the spouse. No spouse goes to the estate. I think that's so wimpy of a thing.
Yeah, it's almost lazy, because they don't. There are so many advantages to a human being the beneficiary of the IRA, and here they don't do any work to try to find a human. The easy one, the spouse. Are they still around? If not, forget it. Go to the estate. They don't look for kids. They don't look for siblings. They don't look for anyone else that's a human that could benefit from being a human as beneficiary, and instead the estate gets named.
Exactly. And just to give you an idea, folks, this is from the TSP. Since we started with the TSP and Chris's mistake, did you announce to everyone you made a mistake, or do we have to? I can't remember.
I did, and I pointed out you didn't fix it, so you're right in the same boat.
Anyways, the TSP, I just thought it would be interesting, just so you understand what some custodians will do. So here's what the TSP says. If no named beneficiary, your account will go first to your spouse. Makes sense. And that's what this other custodian's form said. But then the TSP goes many steps further. If no spouse, to your child or children equally. And then they go even further, Chris, and say, with the share due any deceased child to be divided equally amongst that child's descendants. That's a per stirpes designation, folks, by bloodline. So what the TSP is saying, look, if there's no named beneficiary, we got you covered. It's going to go to your spouse first. If your spouse predeceased you, we still got you covered. It's going to go to your kids. And if your children, any of them, let's say you had three children, if one of them had predeceased you, it will go to the two surviving children, and the third that would have went to the deceased child would go to your grandkids, that child's children. And in the document, Chris, I don't want to get into it, they actually define what a child is. It excludes stepchildren unless legally adopted, but it will include this child and that, and they go on and explain what a child is for purposes of this definition. But then it keeps going, Chris. I mean, this is pretty deep already. Trust me, folks, this is deep already, because these custodians, they don't know who any of these people are, Chris. They actually have to do a little bit of legwork to figure out who these people are and find them. That's why a lot of custodians do what this other custodian did. Goes to your spouse. If no spouse, goes to your estate. Let your estate worry about it.
Right.
We're not going to do this. I got to give the TSP credit here. So if there's no spouse and there's no children and there's no grandchildren, Chris, then it goes to your parents equally if they're still alive. And if they're not alive, then it will go to the appointed executor or administrator of your estate. And that's how it gets passed off, obviously, to your estate. And if they, if the, I guess if the, I don't quite understand this. I kind of understand the last part, but I don't quite understand it. So I'm guessing if maybe the estate was somehow closed, so there's no longer an executor or administrator of the estate, it will go to your next of kin, who is entitled to your estate under the laws of the state you live in. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So I guess what they're saying is if you never created a will, that must be what this is. If you died intestate without a will, so there's no executor or appointed executor or administrator, they're going to then look at the laws of the state you live in. And because they already ruled out the spouse, the children, the grandchildren, and the parents, they're just going to go to your siblings under the rules of the state you live in. I think that's phenomenal. So it really's got the back of these TSP participants who, for some reason or another, forget to name a beneficiary. Now, others will argue, gee, that's not a good thing. This could take a long time to try to track down those people. Or the money might go to some family member the people never wanted it to go to begin with before they died. Well, that's their problem, Chris. They should have then named someone on the beneficiary form. But anyways, I kind of wanted to share that with the listeners and with you that the TSP is one of the more involved lineages before it ultimately gets to your estate. Okay. So let's get back to this thing that I was chatting about that was happening right before I left my road trip to Cincinnati, and that I realized later, goodness, how could I have forgotten that? So let's look again, Chris. What will happen? What are the rules if there's no named human beneficiary? So the rules, Chris, if there's no named human beneficiary, have not changed under the Secure Act. It's the way the rules have always been. And it depends entirely on the age of the person who owned the IRA and died, or 401k or TSP. It depends entirely on their age. If that person died before their required beginning date, which again, folks, is April 1st of the year following the year the IRA owner turns 72. If they die before that day and there is no named human and there's no escape in the custodial agreement, it's going to go to the estate. There's no one else, like in the TSP where they name all these potential people. There's nothing. You're at a custodian that doesn't have anything. It goes to the estate. That IRA has to be closed in 5 years. Pretty straightforward, 5-year rule. But if the person who owned the IRA dies after their required beginning date, then the rule is, not the 5 years, folks, the rule is, the IRA will stretch under the remaining life expectancy of the decedent. So you look at the age of the decedent. If they die after April 1st of the year following the year they turn 72, you take their age, 73, 75, 80, 85, whatever the case may be. You go to the single life expectancy table that the IRS has created. You look up the age of the person in the year they died, not the following year, but in the year they died. And right next to it, Chris, will be a number. And what is that number?
It's called divisor. It's essentially the number of the life expectancy from that age and beyond based on the life tables.
Exactly. It's the single life table, folks. It's what the U.S. government thinks a person that age, how long they are going to live. So it's pretty straightforward. And then you could leave the IRA open that long and begin draining the IRA for the remaining years. The longest period you can have is 13 years. The shortest can be just 1 or 2. Depends on the age of the person who died and what's in the single life table. Now, I said you could leave it open. You're probably not, because you're going to want to close the estate out. Remember, Chris, the money is going to the estate. So the estate has to stay open for the money to come out every year and get paid to the estate and then get paid out. Chances are the estate would just close it right away. What they cannot do is say, no, we're going to use the five-year rule. It's not one or the other. You don't have a choice. The rules are quite explicit. 5 years if no named beneficiary and death occurs before required beginning date. If death occurs on the required beginning date or after, remaining life expectancy of the IRA's owner. So that means every year a required distribution has to come out. Chris is correct. That number is a divisor. What if the number was 4? Because the person who died was in their late 80s, early 90s. It simply means in the first year, you got to take the IRA balance, divide it by 4, and take that money out. Next year, divide it by 3. Next year, 2. Next year, 1. So some pretty big, beefy distributions are going to come out of that and get paid to the estate. Mm-hmm. Well, the estate's not going to want to stay open 5 years, Chris. The estate's going to be, well, I don't want to stay open 4 years in my example. Sorry. And they'll generally close it. But some estates can stay open if you want and just pay it out a little every year for 4 years. Under the five-year rule, it's the same as the 10-year rule. It can be 0000 and then 100%. It's got to be closed within 5 years. But under the, I guess we could call it modified stretch rule, if you will, or remaining life expectancy rule, you got to take a little every year. So in the case that I described, remember I told everyone at the beginning, Chris, as I did all this research, as I looked at the custodial agreement and realized that wasn't going to be any help, I got the dates of debt, the ages rather, of the people who died. I determined that their remaining life expectancy was identical, 5.9 years. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, they're going to be able to keep this open for 5.9 years. And then as I'm driving cross country, I still thought the same thing. And I got here and I attended Ed Slott last week. And instantly on the first day, just a few hours into it, he started reviewing this. Again, not this case, but this complexity of something that sounds so simple. And instantly, I literally hit my forehead and went, damn, I totally forgot that. Do you have any idea what I forgot? Does anyone have any idea? So we got a lot of good listeners.
Yeah, I kept going towards the idea that, I mean, they're not going to want to keep the estate open, so they're going to do something with it before letting it stay there for 5.9 years. Now, there's this whole business about you know, assigning the IRA to the beneficiaries of the will. That whole, you know, which you haven't mentioned. So I don't know. Are you saying that there's something that causes it to have a faster distribution requirement than 5 years?
Not a faster. Let's change the case a little, because there's very little difference between 5 and 5.9.
Right.
Okay. I told you the longest is 13 years. What if this case was 13 years? What if the age of the people who died gave their remaining life expectancy 13 years? They being the people, well, it was one person, I believe the wife inherited.
The named beneficiary wasn't a qualified designated beneficiary.
Does not matter. Remember I said the estate just has to stay open for the remaining life expectancy of the decedent. So they could have kept the estate open if it was 5.9, but let's pretend it was 13. They could have kept the estate open for 13 years, taken the required distribution every year. So the accounts would be drained by the end of the 13 years, but they wouldn't have had to close it in 5. They could have closed it in 13 until I remembered something that I always knew. I blame my stroke. I think the part of my head that had that little tidbit of information was in the part of my brain that the doctor said has died. But as soon as Ed mentioned it, it came back to me. And I know you know the answer. Probably. And you're gonna hit yourself too. And listen, I know there's some listeners who play along with us on this. I know they're racking their brains. I missed a crucial element of everything that I described that prevents this person, if it was in the scenario, from keeping it open for 5.9 years or in a hypothetical scenario, 13 years, why does she still have to close it within 5 and not 5.9 or 13 in my hypothetical? All right, there's enough of an awkward pause of you thinking. All right, remember I said if someone dies before their required beginning date, the five-year rule must apply. No ifs, ands, and buts about it. But if you die on or after your required beginning date, and there's no named human beneficiary, so we're talking the estate here, the estate can keep the IRA open for the remaining life expectancy of the decedent. This couple inherited $2 million Roth IRAs, and they can't do it. And here's the reason, Chris. The required beginning date is what? We haven't really explained to listeners what the required beginning date is. What is the required beginning date? It is the date you are required to start taking required minimum distributions. Mm-hmm. What's the required minimum distributions of Roth IRAs? There are none when you're alive. When you own an IRA,
Died, when they die, they're always before the required beginning date because there isn't
is
one.
No. Right, exactly. Oh I gosh. Totally forgot. I knew that. And we've talked about it on the show.
I paid so little attention to the... I mean, early on when you were talking and you used a lot of words there, the Roth thing registered. So I'm thinking, oh, well, there are RMDs for an inherited Roth. So yeah, there's going to be RMDs. I didn't connect the dots to the required beginning date, but now it makes perfect sense. Yes, I knew that. It was stuck somewhere deep inside. But that's a good point. Yeah, there is no required beginning date. So they had never reached that date. So they have to use the five-year rule.
Yep. So keep this in mind, folks. For all of you who are naming your estate as beneficiary, first, you could slap yourself upside the head because that's a very bad thing to do. But there is never a required, at least right now, Chris, they're not mandating RMDs from Roths. Who knows? They may in the future to keep Roths from getting too big. But there are no RMDs from Roths while you're alive. We're talking about the owner of the Roth dying, folks, not what happens after. Since there is no required beginning date, it is impossible to die on or after your required beginning date, which is the trigger for your estate to use your remaining life expectancy. So, since there's no required beginning date and there's no beneficiary, no human beneficiary, in all cases, a Roth in that situation, has to be closed within 5 years.
Yep. Now, the good news is you don't have to keep the estate open that whole time. But because that can be, you know, can be split to the beneficiaries, the will named beneficiaries, the executor of the estate can do some things to ultimately get it in the hands. But it doesn't grant them then the rights as a human, as beneficiary, because there was all these interim steps that had to happen involving the estate. So you still have play by this five-year rule. It doesn't get you out of that by ultimately, you know, having the estate, the executor specifically, take the IRA and get it moved over to the beneficiaries that are named in the will. Doesn't save you here. Plus, you expose it. The other reason you don't name the estate, you don't want it to go to the estate, is exposes it to creditors and those attacking your estate in the meantime, where it you know would have been protected had it gone directly. So there's the people who are thinking the other part that isn't super well known, because we talk about not naming the estate. I think some people interpret that as you can't ultimately get it to inherited IRAs for the people named in the will, you know, as part of the beneficiary situation in the will. No, it can get to them. You're just not going to maintain all the benefits of naming the human directly in the first place. So the Roth trigger here with no required beginning date. Interesting. That's a unique scenario. I'm sure it happens to a number of people, but that explains why in this particular case, when they called the phone rep, we'll give them kudos. The phone rep was correct. The computer was telling them the right answer. It's got to be 5 years.
Correct. And at first, when they told me, I thought, well, the computer's wrong. It's 5.9.
Yeah.
And again, until I heard that. Now, there's a couple of things I do want to clarify. You are correct. Not naming the beneficiary on the beneficiary forms, naming the estate, or just putting no one. So by default, it's going to go to the estate, assuming the custodial agreements don't intercept it first, like I already described. Mm-hmm. Chris is correct. It will be essentially a probatable asset. Now you have a Roth account that could have moved to humans tax-free, possibly being lost to creditors going after your estate. What if you died owing a lot of medical bills or something, or you caused an accident and you're being sued? Money that would have went to your children tax-free automatically and not been a probatable asset is now a probatable asset and could be lost. But also, Chris, you did mention correctly, the estate could be closed because the executor of the estate can pay out the Roth to little mini inherited IRAs let's say there were 3, 4, 5 children. Yes, they can do that. No custodian's going to allow it. Not one on this earth is going to allow that without a private letter ruling. Because all of the times that the IRS has allowed an estate to pay out to an inherited IRA to beneficiaries through the estate has always come with a private letter ruling. The IRS has not blessed it yet, Chris, with a revenue ruling saying it applies to everyone. Custodians will force you to get a private letter ruling. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there are some custodians that have finally given in and said, well, the hell with it. They always grant these PLRs and so will we. But I was always under the impression, and I'm still under the impression, you got to get a PLR first. Yeah. Yeah. And it costs $20,000 for that PLR.
I think there's been enough PLRs now. My understanding is that the big boys, the big custodians that I don't necessarily need to name, everyone knows who they are, all are playing ball with that now because they've been presented with numerous private letter rulings allowing this. Smaller custodians don't want to mess with it. So I think that is true with a lot of the smaller custodians. But even Slot's own website where they answer questions for people is talking about, you know, you even try sending the PLRs to the custodian to convince them. If that doesn't work, move to a custodian that will let it happen. And they name the big custodians that are allowing this to occur.
So okay. Okay.
I think so that's perfect. Evolved a little bit from the when these PLRs first started coming out, they were all gun shy about it. But I think it's now starting to become more accepted.
And for those who don't know what Chris and I were just saying in English, because we were talking in industry terms, PLR stands for private letter ruling. Why don't you explain what that is, Chris?
Well, it's essentially you petition, you ask permission from the IRS to do something or to interpret the rules a certain way. And you present your case and you argue that you should be able to do something. And then they come back and officially grant you or deny you the ability to do or treat something for tax purposes the way you're proposing. The problem is with a PLR, it applies only to you. It does not necessarily mean that that is now the rule for everyone, that they're only giving you permission to do exactly what was named and described in your particular case. So it's a little dicey when there's just maybe, you know, a single PLR for something to then point at that and say, oh, my situation is essentially the same as that, so I'm going to do the same thing, but I'm not going to pay the $20,000 for the PLR. That can be very dicey, right? But some of these things, that even though they don't do a revenue ruling, whereas they go out and they announce to public, okay, this is how we're going to treat everybody on this particular topic. We've been bombarded with PLR requests on this, so we're now just going to make a revenue ruling out of it. Then it's the law of the land, essentially, and everyone can adhere to those rules. But there's this kind of gray area in between where once there's a number of PLRs that all are ruling consistently on a topic, people become more comfortable behaving that way, knowing the IRS isn't going to come after them. Because that's the fear, that you rely on a PLR and the IRS comes and says, no, you can't. Yours is enough different where that's not going to work. So this has been going on for a while, for quite a while. I think the original PLRs were on this particular topic were, geez, longer than you've been in the Ed Slot program, probably. But I only mention it because they, in one of their official responses to naming an estate as beneficiary, they talk about the major custodians now accepting this as the rule and allowing people to set up these mini inherited IRAs, essentially, is what's happening. Because there's an initial inherited IRA that the estate is in control of. It's the then dicing it up and assigning it, is what they call it, to the will beneficiaries that the executor is trying to transfer assets to. It's that second step that was uncertain, but it looks like it's happening fairly regularly at the big custodians.
Well, that's good to know now that some of them are just saying, hey, to heck with it. And the IRS has always granted the ability to do it. Why they just don't come out with a revenue ruling? And a revenue ruling, unlike a PLR, which only applies to the person who asks for it and pays $20,000 to get it, a revenue ruling applies to everyone. And no one had to pay to get it. It's just when the IRS comes out and says, all right, hey, folks, here's what we're going to do now, and everyone can rely on it. Maybe they'll come out with a revenue ruling someday on that, but it's good to know. But this can all be avoided, people, by naming a beneficiary or having a custodian whose custodial agreement will ultimately get it to someone you want it to go to should you die and your beneficiary you had named died before you.
Yeah, and for those of you thinking, I'm just going to check my custodial agreement, and as long as they list who I want, I'm not going to worry about it. The problem is these custodial agreements can be revised over time. Now, I'm not saying that it's likely that they would change the order of these, well, who are the beneficiaries if there's no living named beneficiary, but these custodial agreements are not etched in stone, never to be changed. They can be changed. You'll be notified of the change, but unless you're on top of things, you may not notice that they changed the order and it's not the order you want anymore. Why open yourself up to all of that ambiguity? Just name who you want on the form.
Like Ed says, name names. Yeah. Remember that Seinfeld episode with the Chinese food and everybody wanted to get Chinese food, but Elaine messed it up?
No, you know, remember that? I remember that one.
Yeah, she named names and she got Jerry blacklisted and a few other people. And it was funny, but name names. This is Seinfeld for everything. So name names. Okay, yeah. So let's wrap up the last two. These we can go a little bit fast on, but it's going to scratch your head on something. We talked about this in the past, but let's mention it again. So remember, the second class of beneficiaries, which the government calls non-eligible designated beneficiaries, I like to call them human beneficiaries who cannot stretch.
But that's a nice descriptive name.
Mm-hmm. Whereas the other beneficiary that we just talked about, the non-designated beneficiaries, we call them non-humans. Next one, human beneficiaries who just can't stretch. Right. Perfect. Okay, the government calls them non-eligible designated beneficiaries. These are the people who have to close the inherited IRA or 401k or TSP within 10 years. And you TSPers who think, aha, we don't have to worry about this, that is true. the TSP was exempted from the SECURE Act. But I got news for you. You got 3 months to die. Because beginning January 1st of 2022, the TSP is now under the SECURE Act.
Right. So they granted them some leeway to get their ducks in a row in preparation for these new rules. That's all. You weren't lifetime exemption.
As a libertarian, don't get me going on this. The government creates a rule and made everyone abide by it less than 6 weeks after the rule took place. And they said, except for our employees.
Right.
We're going to give them 2 years to straighten out their estate documents. Don't get me going on that one. But the TSP, you're going to be under this come January 1st of 2022. Okay. Non-eligible designated beneficiaries or human beneficiaries who just can't stretch. 10 years. Doesn't matter when the owner dies. Doesn't matter if the guy dies before or after the required beginning date. It's 10 years. And that's kind of a head scratcher. Mm-hmm. But it's just 10 years. That's
right. Right. So it kind of negatively affects a few people that could have stretched over the remaining life expectancy of someone who died not very far past their required beginning date. Not drastically, though, 13 years versus 10. It's not a giant thing, but it is there. It is a punishment, essentially, or penalty with the SECURE Act having this blanket rule of 10 years.
Exactly. So that's just it. And once the 10 years has been established, we talked about this on the show in the past as well, but I'll mention it again. Once an IRA, a TSP, a 401k, a 457, a 403b, whatever the heck it is you have, and TSP, this doesn't happen to you for another couple of months, but January 1st of 2022. Once the 10 years is set, Chris, that's it. If that person dies, the person who inherited it dies, yes, they can name a successor beneficiary. That successor doesn't get a new 10 years.
Right.
They share that same 10 years. Yep. But what makes it unique, there is no required distribution during that 10-year period. Mm-hmm. For the first 9 years and 364 days, perhaps, in the best-case scenario, but that first nine-plus years, Chris, you can take out as little or as much as you want. It just has to be fully closed by December 31st of the year following the owner's death. However, if you were allowed to stretch it, which you can't, the estate could if they were a non-human. Again, a head scratcher on that one, Chris. The estate could have used it for the rest of their life expectancy. Well, there's no life expectancy of the estate. For the rest of the life expectancy of the owner.
Yeah.
But they have to take out money every year. It's not like they can let it sit and then take it out at the end. So it's kind of six of one, half dozen of the other. Do you want the flexibility to manage 10 years of payouts? And this is what Ed was trying to point out. Even if that rule did exist, maybe it wouldn't have been the best rule, forcing someone who inherits an IRA, which would be your kids. This second category of beneficiary folks, which I call human beneficiaries who cannot stretch, that's essentially your kids. They're never going to be able to stretch unless they're disabled or
haven't reached the age of majority.
But they still have to take out RMDs. Right. I'm talking the. It's not that you're. There's disabled, and what's the other? I'll get to the category in a second. Where is it? Okay, I'm going to cheat. Disabled? Chronically ill. That's the one. I always get chronically ill and disabled confused. If your child is chronically ill, meaning they can't do two of six activities of daily living, they can stretch as well. But anyways, just wanted to point that out. There is no choice. You must do the 10-year if you are a human beneficiary who cannot stretch. Simple as that. But Ed says, and I agree with him, that's actually not a bad thing. Because if you were forced to use the remaining life expectancy like the estate is, there is an RMD every year and you wouldn't be able to do tax planning. At least under the 10-year rule, it gives your children 10 years to figure out their tax situation and maybe start taking out more in 1 year and less than another, depending on what the tax situation is. So you do have that flexibility for that first 10 years. Does that kind of make sense?
Yes.
Now let's get to the final category, because here it gets a little bit confusing again, folks. The government calls this category eligible designated beneficiaries. I call them humans who can stretch.
Right.
So we got the humans who cannot stretch and the humans who can stretch. If you're a human who can stretch, and essentially that would be the surviving spouse. However, the surviving spouse has their own unique rules. So no surviving spouse is going to pretty much do anything Chris and I are going to describe. They're a separate category. We'll talk about them later on another show. It's essentially minor children, as you already mentioned, Chris, until they reach their age of majority. Disabled individuals, chronically ill individuals. And the one that I really think they were trying to get, Chris, I think this is the beneficiary the government was really trying to help, where they pretty much said, it doesn't really matter because they're close in age. And the government created a category of humans not more than 10 years younger than the IRA owner who died. Right. Essentially, siblings, brothers and sisters, because you're all kind of within 10 years of each other. Now, that's not mm-hmm. all the time. There's some much more than 10 years apart. And the government, Chris, well, you kind of pegged it, I think, when you said, and you can offer your opinion if I'm quoting you wrong, but the government was pretty much throwing up their hands and saying, we're pretty much going to get the money out just as fast if the guy lived or died.
Right. I think that's why they kind of left it alone and not tried to punish, because I think they were targeting people who were intentionally naming really young beneficiaries, trying to get the best, you know, the most benefit out of the stretch possible. And they shut that off. But for people who weren't trying to work the system, if you will, by taking advantage of a super young beneficiary, they said, no, they're not trying to do anything. They're just, you know, don't have anybody to leave it to who's real young. They're leaving it to a sibling, most likely, or someone close to their same age. They're not trying to work the system, so let's leave them alone. That's my interpretation of how they came up with this rule. I have no idea if that was their thought process, but that's how, you know, I guess that's what I'm going to believe until I hear differently.
So keep in mind again, folks, an eligible designated beneficiary, or what I like to call a human who can stretch, their payout option is the stretch. They stretch and they go under the old rules, under the stretch rules. However, they, unlike humans who cannot stretch, humans who can stretch, Chris, could choose the 10-year payout if they want. Because remember, under stretch, they got to take a little every year, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So they could choose the 10-year rule if they want. But there's a big caveat with that, and you better get this one right.
Uh-oh.
What do you think the caveat is on choosing if you can do the 10-year rule or the stretch, giving you the choice, or when the stretch becomes non-negotiable and you must stretch? The humans who can stretch are given a little window of opportunity, folks, to choose between a stretch or the 10-year. Do you have any idea what that window is, Chris?
Well, A, don't they have to, they only have this option if the decedent died before the required beginning date, right?
Perfect. That's the answer.
Oh.
If the IRA owner...
That's not
owner,
what I would call a window, but yeah. That's,
well, it is a window. If the IRA owner dies before April 1st of the year following the year they turn 72, if they die before that, the eligible designated beneficiary, which for the most part is going to be brothers and sisters.
Right. Can only stretch.
Now, remember, spouses are unique and they're going to do something totally different, so don't even count them. A disabled person or a chronically ill person... Yes, they fall into a special category, and they would be given a choice as well. They can stretch, but for the most part, it's brothers and sisters. If the sibling died or the IRA owner died before their required beginning date, those humans who can stretch have a choice. Do I want to close this within 10 years, but not have to take anything out during that 10-year period and maybe do some tax planning? Or do I want to keep this open for the rest of my, meaning their, my remaining life expectancy, but be forced to take a little bit of money every single year? They'll have the choice between the two. But if the IRA owner dies after April 1st of the year on or after April 1st of the year following the year they turn 72, that human who can stretch must stretch.
Right. Essentially, once RMDs have started, you can't shut them off as a beneficiary and elect the 10-year. That's what's going on there.
Once RMDs of the decedent would have started, right, is essentially what that rule is.
Right. Once that's triggered, once they start, you can't go back and undo it and say, oh, now that I'm the beneficiary, I'm going to elect the 10-year rule. Nope, RMDs have started to come out. You're going to have to keep doing that.
And the required beginning date, folks, will change, especially if son of secure, this is what Ed calls it, son of secure passes, where they want to push RMDs out to 75, which he still says is really not a good thing. People still are going to want to take money out before that to do tax planning. But the new required beginning date will become whatever age RMDs are. So it used to be April 1st of the year following the year you turn 70 and a half. Now it's April 1st of the year following the year you turn 72. And in the future, it might be the same thing, but a different year. So your required beginning date does change. And you hit the nail on the head, Chris. The IRS is essentially at that point saying, look, had this guy not died, we would have started getting money at this point. So you don't have the choice of the 10-year if he dies after that point and keep us from getting our money for 10 more years. But if you die before that, they're saying, look, the guy wasn't subject to RMDs. Yeah, we'll give you a choice. Do you want to start him now over your remaining life expectancy? Or do you want to do nothing for 10 years and just close the account by the end of that 10th year? So anyways, you got to really listen to this show a few times if you want to be able to follow all of this. It's something that sounds so simple, but in practicality can be very confusing, and even did stump me up and obviously stumped Chris and maybe some of you old-time Vanguardian do-it-yourselfer listeners who also, and I know we talked about Roth's not having a required beginning date in the past. I know we talked about that. I totally forgot about it when I was presented with that case. And boom, I just remembered. Yep. And that explains why the custodian, and this custodian is a very, very good custodian. And I was at first shocked thinking, God, how could they not have picked up on that? And no, they had it right. It was me who totally forgot. Roth IRAs have no required beginning date when there's no named human beneficiary. It's got to be closed within 5 years.
Yep.
All right.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining me remotely again. I think you're back next week, right? We've got a Q&A show with Bob. I'm doing a Bob tax Q&A here coming up. That'll be the next show that posts. And then next week, you'll be back in the office to do an EDU show again, right?
That is correct. I will not be able to record this Friday because I am changing Airbnbs and leaving this little town called Monroe and relocating for 2 to 3 days. It depends if I stay the third day or not. Pretty much right in the heart of Cincinnati because I'm supposed to go to that Halloween party Friday night as Mr. Potato Head. And you'll be proud of me. I bought a needle and some thread, black thread, white thread, and red thread. And spent a Sunday afternoon watching football and sewing the mustache, mouth, nose, and eyes onto my Mr. Potato Head costume.
I can't wait to see pictures.
Well, it's cute little Mr. Potato Head, but...
Well, we'll be the judge of that. We'll put it on the website. So, okay. Well, we want to thank everybody for listening once again to... kind of a complicated EDU show. You might think it was a simple situation, name a beneficiary. Oh, it's not the estate, or it's not a named beneficiary, it's the estate. What are the ramifications? Well, can be various ramifications depending on the situation. So thank you very much for listening once again. If you have your own idea or for an EDU show, or you have a question for a Q&A show, go to the website jimhelps.com. On there you'll find a contact form. You can send in questions or in comments. You can also email Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. Either way works. And you have a safe week. I guess I'll talk to you next. I'm sure I'll talk to you before that. But
yep, I should be back, hopefully. Actually, no, I will not be back by next Tuesday. I'll still be driving on Tuesday. So there'll be 2 weeks of Bob.
Oh, okay. Or something else. We'll figure something out.
Something else. Yes.
We'll talk about it. So it'll be a surprise EDU show next week. We don't know the topic yet. Well, we didn't know the topic this week until right before the show. But either way, everybody have a great week. We'll be back next time with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.